Welcome to Work Matters, where we explore what leaders can do to make work more productive, valuable, meaningful, and impactful. I am your host, Thomas Bertels.
In today's episode of Work Matters, it is my distinct pleasure to talk with Dart Lindsley about the role of middle management. Dart is an HR leader who held leadership roles at companies world-renowned for their talent practices. He is the head of global process excellence for people operations at Google, and prior to that, led the HR transformation planning and analysis organization for Cisco Systems. He is also the host of the Work for Humans podcast. In our discussion, we explore what makes the role of middle managers so challenging, what are the competencies of effective middle managers, and what can managers do to source work that maximizes the value for both the business and their team. We also explore how managers can preserve their degrees of freedom while staying in alignment with the organization's strategic direction. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and if you do so, please don't forget to like and subscribe. So, without further ado, welcome to Work Matters.
Thank you very much, Thomas, for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back. I think you were a guest on, I want to say, season two. And today we're talking again, and we decided that we want to talk about middle management. And you used to be a middle manager, but I understand that, you know, more recently you actually made a change to your role. Maybe give us a little bit of background as to like what the change was. Why did you make it?
Yeah, I was a middle manager for a long time. I made the change in part because I went to 20% in my current role at Google. And so you can't be a manager and be 20%. And I did that so that I could work more on my main project, which is improving the experience of work by treating it like a product. And so I will tell you, though, it was a big relief to stop being a manager. And a part of the reason for that is I felt enormous responsibility for the lives and experiences of my team. And it's a big job. And it's a lot of work. And so it was kind of a relief to put it down, at least for a while.
This is something that I've heard a lot over, I want to say, the last 10, 15 years, maybe even longer, that it seems increasingly people don't see, it's like the typical management career as something very desirable. And especially, I believe, when it comes to middle managers, I think we're having, it's like a little bit of a crisis that people really don't want to step into these roles. Because oftentimes people get sandwiched in. There's the forces from the top that say, produce more, right, make something happen. But there are also now increasingly forces from the bottom where employees say, we're not going to show up anymore. We're not going to be engaged. What have you experienced? What have you in your middle management role seen as your biggest frustrations?
I'm going to talk about this in two ways. First, I'm going to talk about it from studies I've done. And then I'll talk about it in terms of my own experience, which I think reflects that. I don't know how long ago it was now, 15 years ago when I was part of Cisco Systems, conducted a study which was called the Manager Work Experience Study. And we went around the world and we embedded ourselves in the lives of managers in different countries, six different countries. We lived with them. We interviewed them. We asked them what their experience was, what was good about their job, what was bad about their job, how we could equip them better. And we came away with a lot of learnings, but one of the most central things that we learned was that managers find themselves pulled in two directions. That one direction is the needs of the business, and the other direction is the needs of their teams. I came to believe over time that we are not equipping managers to deal with both sides of that equation. And so managers are positioned in a place where, this is my general philosophy, the organization sees the workforce as an input to production and thinks of people in a quite limited way. And I'm not saying that this is what we say we do, but it's what we do, which is that we think of people as inputs to production, which is things. And I spoke about this the last time I was on your show. So what happens to middle managers when that's the case? I'm being told as a manager and that I need to create productivity for my team. And I am being given the tools, the limited tools of what you would do to to acquire an input to production, which is I have pay and I have holidays and I have just a couple of other things, but it's not actually treating the team as whole people. And so I, as a manager, can see my team. They're right in front of me. They're whole people to me. They're not inputs to production to me. Many of them are my friends. And yet I'm being equipped with systems to treat them like things. I think performance management is a classic example of something that's about extracting value out of a team that traps managers into behaviors that they find morally injurious to them. And it's a very hard thing for a middle manager.
It seems like, at least from my vantage point, that we're giving them only half the tools that they need to manage people, let alone like design work to be motivating and productive. But they're also being forced into like a very rigid application of the tools that they get, right? Everybody gets a biweekly one-on-one. Everybody gets an annual performance review, although we're all different.
Yeah, there's one thing that you just said that sparked an idea for me, which is that there's a cascade of distrust. And it goes like this. I don't trust your team to be productive on their own. So we need to institute ways to control that. I don't trust you, manager, to manage them in a way that's going to make them productive. And so I'm going to tell you how to do your job as it relates to performance management or whatever else. And so this is a part of the problem, is that cascade of distrust. Now, in terms of the gaps in tooling, it took me ages to figure out what was missing. What was missing. And by tooling, I don't mean systems. Systems can help, but generally systems in the past have been used for purposes of inventory management of people. And my feeling is that whenever you put a whole person into a system, they become a thing because you reduce their complexity so enormously that you cannot represent them effectively in systems. And so what I realized is that the tooling that is missing because of how we framed managers. And so we framed managers as being in a controlling role above teams. And we have framed managers as essentially a conduit of leadership control. And that's an incomplete model. And so what I've come to believe is that because I believe that employees are customers, and because that makes organizations multi-sided, so now they're multi-sided businesses, that means that managers' role changes. So one thing about managers' roles is that they become brokers, which is that you have your traditional customer on one side and you have the employee customer on the other side. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to optimize the economy, which is that work is flowing from the traditional customer toward the employee. And the employee, one of the traditional models is that everybody hates work. That's just wrong. Work can be fantastic when it's allocated in ways that match your passions and that interest you. And so here's a valuable thing coming from the traditional customer, which is work. And a manager's job is in part to allocate that work among team members based upon what they find rewarding. And it's also in part to win the kind of work that they are going to find rewarding. And so that whole philosophy has been missing from the management vocabulary and from the methodological tooling for managers. The second thing that is missing is in a model where work is a product and employees are customers, managers are designers. So they are product managers. So they and should think about themselves. And so they need to be equipped with product management tools. And one of those is need finding tools. So when I have a conversation, when I have a career conversation in the traditional model with you, what I'm asking you is, where do you want to end up? But when I ask you as a product designer, and I'm doing needs finding, I ask you, what's the in-the-moment experience of work that you want to have so that I can build a product that you actually want to consume and that you want to subscribe to? And so this is a whole reframe. It's a methodological difference. And to go back to my own personal experience is that I went through years where I was trying to be a good manager using the traditional model. And it did cause, like I said, moral injury to me. And an example of that is, well, the first time I had to lay off a big chunk of my team, and I realized that I hadn't been preparing them for a job beyond this one. And so what that meant was that they exited the company, and I had an opportunity to upskill them, and I hadn't taken it. And so I swore never to do that again, because there are times when layoffs are going to happen, and you need to be always preparing so that you don't have any regrets about how you managed. I think performance management tools have made me lie to my team by accident, which is the messaging around performance management tools is one thing, but it's a gaslighting message, and the reality is something else. Because I believed the original story and I communicated that to my team, I ended up lying to them by accident. So anyway, those are the examples of from my own experience where I found the traditional model did not support me.
Yeah, I can definitely see how it fails if you look at it through the lens of the employee as the customer, and we want to serve up a product that really brings out the best in that person. But I feel it also fails on the other dimension. For example, one thing I find is that there's a lot of middle managers that have a very difficult time articulating what high productivity looks like for their team. They have like a bunch of metrics or KPIs, but they really don't get at the heart of like, what is productivity and how do we unlock that? A lot of times I do an exercise. I go in there and ask people within your function, right? Talk to me about all the things that the team does. And then let's figure out roughly how much time goes against that, because that's at the end of the day, all we have. And it's always an eye-opening experience for them, because they never really thought about where does the human capacity go. It's a very sort of classic productivity view. The fascinating thing I find is, though, that when you look at this and you see some of the craziness, I oftentimes see that there's sort of like a lack of interest to fix that work product, right? To take out the part that's really not value-added and redirect that time towards something that drives value. And I'd love to get your perspective on it, because it feeds, I think, a little bit into how do you make the work better, right? How do you give people higher value work, upskill them? But I just feel that it doesn't happen. And I'm curious why, because organizations are supposed to be so focused on productivity. And that's like the mantra from the top. Any thoughts on that?
Yes, huge thoughts. I completely agree. And here's the way I have tackled that with my teams, and now I'm actually giving this to other teams. The bubble chart is a practice. Every month, we ask ourselves as a team how we have allocated our attention. And I'm not concerned with hours. I'm concerned with attention. And it's partially because I think that the idea of hours is kind of misleading. I dream about my job. I think about my job when I'm mountain biking. And the question is, you know, hours are, yes, are a limitation, but attention is also a limiting factor in a sort of a theory of constraints way. Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, said that consciousness is an attention allocating device. And so how a team allocates its attention is the consciousness of the team. So on a monthly basis, we ask ourselves, how have we allocated our work against a set of work categories. And usually for us on my team, that's projects, but it can be run the business work for other people. And so we have a bubble chart where the size of the bubble is how much attention. The x-axis is business value, and it's specifically risk-adjusted business value. So the farther to the right, the more business value. The vertical axis is how core to mission is that work to us as a team. And so think of the business value as the whole company and the core to mission as the value of the team and how much value is the team producing. And so things that are core to mission are high margin because our team is being used for the thing it is best at. You know, that's what we're for. That's why we exist. If we're doing something else, we're probably suboptimized. And then the last dimension is the color of the bubbles. And the color of the bubbles is how rewarding is the work to you. And so if a bubble is, you know, if it's green, great. We actually have a scale for the different levels. Green, bright green, level 5, it's some of the best work I've ever done. The next level down is, it's great, I'm in a flow, it's fine. The one below that is called stale cupcakes, which is, it's not the worst thing I've ever had, but it's not great. So it's sort of the meh level. The one below that is, I'm sleeping in wet clothes. It's not nice. And the one below that is, I'm walking on glass, barefoot. And so we have this scale that we use. And then, and so if something goes even into the yellow, even if it's stale cupcakes, we have a discussion about why is that the case. And there's usually two reasons why that's the case, or two dimensions along which that's the case. One of them is people want to buy a product that does the job that they want it to do for them. So is the work actually rewarding? And then the other question is about cost, which is, can I buy that product at a reasonable cost? And so both of those dimensions are reasonable. So things go into stale cupcakes routinely because they're not costly to me, but it's not rewarding work. They go into, you know, below 3 because the cost is getting too great. And they go into red because this is actually something that's harming me. And so the purpose of this is to say, let's allocate our attention in a way that is optimizing the team's output. But it's a multi-sided output, which is, it's not just value to the traditional customer, it's also value to the team. And so this model completely, first of all, it's a very leading indicator, which is when things go red, bubbles move for different reasons. They can drop in terms of business risk-adjusted business value because the project lost its sponsorship. And so it goes down to like 10 on a scale of 1 to 100 in terms of its likelihood of success. We should stop working on that project really quickly because that thing's dead. You know, so that's one different reasons they drop in, they drop in terms of business value, and they drop in terms of core to mission because you know, somebody, we went in as process improvement engineers and we're being asked to be project managers, or we're being asked to do run the business work. Okay, we should pop that bubble. And so this is an example of the kind of tooling that a manager whose job is to optimize a multi-sided market would have. And the way I think of it is fires, when you are sitting around a campfire, that's a classic multi-sided model. It has fuel and it has oxygen. And how you stack the logs in a fire is going to determine how bright it burns. And what you're doing is you're optimizing the flow of oxygen over the fuel. And that's what the bubble chart does.
I think that's super interesting. And I can definitely see the value of that if you're in a project-based business and you have some discretion about shaping these projects. And maybe as they come in, also position yourself. This is something you don't want to do at all, right? Position yourself that maybe they go somewhere else. But how does this model play out if you're in an operational role, right? Where you, for example, manage
hiring processes, recruiting processes, right? High volume recruiting. And you're so interdependent on your functional partners or your counterparts at the same level. Any thoughts on that? Because obviously there, right, you have limited ability to shape the overall product or even say no to the overall product.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's a question of how much agency and freedom do teams have to adjust this. Sometimes it's difficult to adjust what comes into your team as work, but there's still flexibility. I have a cold, by the way, so I'm trying to articulate through a cold. You often have flexibility to allocate work to people, and I'll give you a couple of examples of this. But one of the things I want to point out is that the traditional model wants to find the formula that describes what all people want from work, and it's looking for a unified theory because it's trying to apply at scale something that's going to make people productive. This takes a very different approach, my approach, which is it's the differences among people that make it possible to optimize work allocation. If everybody was identical, you couldn't optimize allocation. And so an example is, I was a recruiter, so I know how that worked. I really liked recruiting software engineers, product managers, and mechanical engineers. I did not like recruiting marketing people, and I didn't like recruiting software engineers as you got toward embedded software, because the closer I got to hardware, the less I enjoyed the personalities of the people I was recruiting. It's just the facts. Well, sure, we've all got to recruit, but you could allocate to me the kind of people I like to recruit. And there's somebody else who's like, no, man, I love my expertise down at the hardware level. And so there is flexibility. There's amazing. Or I'm supporting customers across 3 time zones. And just by allocating work to people based upon their time zone, I can allocate work to time zones that are less costly to the people who work there. So these are just a couple of examples. There's a lot of freedom. And so they just decided to change how they work.
I mean, I love the bubble chart. One other thought it sparks to me is that probably one of the things to look for on that chart is also your R&D or your innovation, right? What is the work that we're undertaking to improve our own work, rather than just look at this, right? These are all customer demands, right? We only exist for the customer. Is that something that shows up in your bubble chart?
Absolutely. So the top right-hand quadrant is stuff that's producing immediate value to the company. Just to the left of the midline is your loss leaders, and so for my team, an example of a loss leader is we're going to measure the cycle time of the staffing process. Measurement doesn't produce any value. Projects to decrease cycle time produce value. And so a measurement project is a loss leader, which we hope is going to create a project that's going to provide business value. A little farther to the left are operational experiments. And they're very high because you're the only organization in the company that can improve that can operate on your operations. That's 100% your job, but it's a very indirect kind of value. And so it shows up very high, but far to the left in terms of business value because it's very indirect. The bubble chart should not be all crowded bubbles up in the top right. There should be a distribution. And so the bottom right quadrant is things that are high business value, but not core to mission. And that's good citizenship work, which is it's things you do because somebody has to do them and the company needs somebody to do them, even though it's not your job. And so you do it for a little while, but you try to pop that bubble. And then the ones that are low business value and not core to mission, you can have bubbles there. There's somebody on the team who wants to learn something that is not directly aligned to what we do, but it's a part of their career path. That's fine. Let's just show it there. It's some work that we're doing. It's some of where our attention's going. Shouldn't be a giant bubble, but it can be there. That's a legitimate use of attention.
So one of the questions I like to ask to introduce this concept of work design is to ask people for the best job they ever had and give me the attributes, and for the worst job they ever had and list the attributes. I'd be curious to know what was like your best and your worst middle management job, and what made it the best or the worst job.
They followed in sequence. The worst job I ever had was when I joined Google. And it was my first year because I was leading a team that was not positioned to produce value. we were between two very powerful teams. We were between the staffing organization and the engineering organization, and we were meant to be the liaison. There were only six of us. Both of those organizations were enormous, and both of them were mighty. And in particular, at Google, the team that builds our staffing solutions is actually the engineering organization, the most prestigious. It's not an IT organization. It's the most prestigious group of people in the company. And so there was a real question between the two about which was the more powerful. So it was a very, very, two very powerful teams. And my tiny little team was in the middle and was designed to actually be the liaison and control that relationship. And it was just impossible. It made me so incredibly unhappy. And there were a couple of other things about it, which is that I had left my previous company where I'd been for 18 years, and I'd left all my friends. And I did not realize when I did that how much of how I get things done is because people trust me after they get to know me. And so I had a network of people at my old company that would do two things for me. One is I could call in a favor, and I could beg forgiveness. And so people had enough of a track record with me that when I wasn't successful at something, they would understand that I had been successful at the last 10 things. And so it was an anomaly. And so in the same year, my father died, and I thought, I can work through this. And no, is the answer. That's very challenging. You cannot. A friend of mine said that when a family member dies, you should expect to be crazy for exactly a year at least. And so there was that. Another thing is that at my previous company, management was actually a prestigious role. It was valued. And it's less so in a company where the coolest people in the company are coders. The coolest people in the company are not management. Whereas if you work at a company like, let's say Procter & Gamble, management is a respected discipline at Procter & Gamble. And it's an intentionally underpowered one in some other organizations. So that was horrible, absolutely horrible. But I made a proposal. I proposed creating a process design team, a process excellence team. And everybody said, that's a really good idea. We should do that, but don't eliminate the old team. So I was like, okay. So I put up a sign that said, we do process improvement, and to see if there was a market. So just to test if there's a market, and people started coming. And at first they didn't want process improvement. They just wanted process documentation. But we were able to do process documentation. And bit by bit, I started taking resources from the old team and moving them over. And for the old team, I just opened the door. I said, look, if somebody would like to go work on this project, come on over. And bit by bit, we did do that movement. And I want to point out a couple of things here. Google, as a company, allowed me enough freedom to do that. And I have enormous respect for that freedom, because there's so many organizations where there would not have been, like, you would have to do some sort of federal case where you'd have to go and make a presentation to, I don't know who, to make this happen. But instead, we did it in a very market-based way. We saw there was a market for it. We started moving it. We did ultimately do a reorg. And then the next 4 years of that team were some of the best of my career. And a part of it was that we structured the team to serve a very large swath of the organization, which meant that we had a lot of freedom to pick and choose the work that was coming to us. And we set it up under the principles of multi-sided management or of two-sided management, which is that we are trying to win the kind of work the team wants to do and provide the most value to the team, to the organization that we possibly can. And so I've come up with sort of a whole philosophy called leading from the sewer, which is, how do you, as a line manager, lead a company? And the answer is, you absolutely can. Line managers are some of the most powerful people in the organization because they are the people who are getting stuff done. You go much above line manager and you start being about presentations. You start being about, you know, one executive presenting to other executives, whereas a line manager is right there where stuff gets done. And the truth is, the layer of line managers, when they are working together effectively, can move mountains in real time. And so I think that there's a lot to be said about what's hard about middle management, but there's a lot to be said about what are the techniques of masterful leading from the sewer. And I have a few, which I'd be happy to mention.
I fully agree with you. I think there's a huge opportunity, I think, for middle managers to add value. Right? You know a lot of the operation and you're elevated enough that you're not in the weeds, yet you're not yet in the stratosphere. I think the question for me is, has the organization or senior leadership created the conditions to tap into that energy? Because I've seen this getting wasted so many different ways. Right, you have five really smart people, but the incentives are just pulling people into different directions. Right, there's not enough goodwill to make the right things happen, because right, it just doesn't move a needle on somebody's scorecard. I'm sure you've seen similar things and other things that just get in the way, and right, although people might have, even if they have that aptitude, that interest, right, the willingness to do something. Just a lot of these efforts fail because the system is a little bit rigged against people collaborating and moving mountains, as you say.
No, that's very true. And so one of the things is that you have to provide managers with the degrees of freedom, like I was provided in this particular story, to do the right thing for the company. And when I have found myself in situations, not at my present company, where that was not the case, that's the time to become subversive and to do the right thing for the company, despite what your incentives are even. And so, and despite what, you know, the constraints. And I find that fun too. I actually find it very fun to, like, I've got a secret plan, you know, sort of thing. But I really have to respect my current management for giving that, the freedom to line managers. There's ways in which line managers are not very powerful or equipped, but that was a good thing. And I'll tell you that the tricks of what I call leading from the sewer, one of them is always optimize for degrees of freedom. So make sure that that you are always in a position to have as many choices as possible in terms of how you're going to run your team. Because the more constrained you get, the less opportunity you have to optimize. There are tricks to that. And one of those is, for example, always serve top leaders across many organizations so that they value you and no one organization eats you. Because if you get pulled into a single organization and start serving a single organization, you will lose degrees of freedom. Another rule is don't brag about overachieving for two reasons. One is that if you're a service organization like mine, the bragging rights need to go to your client. And so if you can continue to make your client put them in a position to brag and to shine, they will come back to you. But if you shine, they won't. And the second thing is, if you admit to overachieving, you will be asked to overachieve the same way next year, and you will lose your degrees of freedom. Now, all of these things require you to not want many of the perks that go with advancement in an organization, because you're optimizing for freedom, not altitude.
Relative to advancement, I think we created this bizarre situation where we know that as managers, to be effective, you got to have lots of degrees of freedom. You got to have a job that you can grow, evolve. Right? I think Peter Drucker in 73, said you can't make a manager's job big enough. That's one thing. But that obviously then creates fairly flat organizations, which then minimizes the ability for people to climb the ladder and get their dopamine fix of promotion every 18 months. I think it's hard for leaders, but also for employees, to wean themselves off that model that provides this visible move up the hierarchy.
One of my favorite thinkers, Colonel John Boyd, he worked in the Pentagon. He's the military thinker who completely redesigned strategy for the United States. But he also worked in the Pentagon building jets and designing jets. The way he saw the dynamic in the Pentagon was this. We want to make a nimble fighter jet. The problem is that people in the Pentagon get promoted for the size of their budget. And what that means is that every person who's going to add a component to our airplane is incented to make it as heavy as possible. Because the more of the plane is their components, the more of the plane is going to promote them. So it's completely the wrong incentives. And so what he said to his team is, do you want to be somebody or do you want to do something? And that's the choice you have to make, to be or to do. I think that same choice exists in a lot of companies. And the dopamine fix of getting things done is far more enduring than the dopamine fix of promotion, which is fleeting. Given my choice, I would rather do something than be somebody. And that's often rewarded, but not always rewarded. And so you just have to accept that if you want to do something, sometimes it will be, particularly it will be illegible. And so I'll give you examples of that. Also, one of my favorite thinkers, the person who wrote Seeing Like a State, said that when you're governing a country, one of the mistakes you make is that you try to make the populace legible. And you're doing that because you're trying to optimize your country. And so you create measures which are overly simplified because the world's complex. And then the next thing you do is you find out that the world's too complex, your measures aren't working, so you start asking people to become more simple. And so lots of mistakes are made that way. There are things that you might need to do as middle management, which are strategic, but you are working in an organization that cares about quarterly or annual returns. And so one of the reasons why it's useful to underplay what you can get done in the year is so that you have resources to get something done that's more strategic. For instance, growing talent for the long term. growing your team's capabilities for 2 years from now, 3 years from now. That's not going to show up as in the year value. In fact, it's going to be very illegible in terms of your ability to say, I did this. But 2 years from now, you're going to be really happy you did it. 3 years, 4 years, you're going to be in a much better position to get more done.
I think that requires a highly intrinsically motivated middle manager that in a way acts against his own sort of career self-interest in the short run.
Correct. The way I say that is, if you want to get the most important things done for your company, you can't want what they have to give you. And so you have to want something else. And for me, what I want is I want to get stuff done. And I want to see my team, I want to see my team thrive. You're going to be in an environment where that's considered failure by many of your peers, because the only measure of success among many peers is promotion. And you just have to live with that. You have to have your own standards.
I like that. I think it's anchored in your own value system, which makes it very robust. Flip side is you might be in conflict with whatever the corporate's direction at the time is, sometimes more than others.
Yeah, that's right. And you have to manage that. The first rule, I learned this from Alex Komorowski. The first rule is don't die. After that, there's a lot of freedom.
I think you and I would probably both agree that I think that there's tremendous potential in that middle management role. Because not everybody wants to be a senior executive and wants to have all that stress and all that responsibility. Right? Some people, I think, are very happy to operate at a level where they can contribute optimally. The appreciation of that role, I oftentimes don't see. The frozen middle, we call them sometimes. That's where change dies. And that's kind of where we find the cost savings, right? When we do spans and layers reductions and so forth. So I think it's a population in the organization that most of the time is seen as a liability rather than an asset.
That's a very interesting point, which is if you're leading a large scale change, it's going to go through middle managers. And if middle managers believe that it's idiotic, it's going to be impossible to get through. And I do think it's very important for every manager to be very aware of the strategic direction of the company and be an exemplary example of the change in that direction. It's a risk, right, being as independent of a manager as I have been, that you might be running counter to the true strategy of the organization. And so you have to be very careful that that's not what you're doing. There's a level of hubris that goes with saying, I think I have a better idea. And so you have to be careful that you're not wrong. And you have to be the first out the door and the first out of the trench in change. And so, and again, what does it mean to be first out of the door in change? Sometimes it means you're shot, right? And also, lots of changes that you're first out of the trench on are going to be ones that where everybody says, oh, back in the trench. And you're like, I'm out in the field getting shot. So, that's also, you have to take some personal risk to be that person.
I think it's very interesting to think about what are the competencies, right, that a highly effective middle manager would have to bring to the table. And it obviously depends on the role that they're occupying, right? Whether they're more in a staff role or in a line role. It depends a lot on the organizational culture. But I also hear in our conversation that there's probably a couple of themes that are universal, no matter what. One strikes me as the management and constant optimization of the work of the team through the lens of both business and employee, doing important work and doing work that is valued by those people that are doing that. The constant representation of such that team's work and being plugged in, especially if you're in a project organization, so that you don't develop, right? It's a dependency on a single customer. There's a selling job to it. There's a work design aspect to that. There is a humanistic element to be able to, right, leverage the unique variations among the team. What else comes to mind?
So you sparked an idea, and it might be smaller than the big question you just asked, but a part of what makes the bubble chart work is that you need to be conducting net promoter analyses of the customer, and you need to be sharing that with the team. And a part of the reason for that is that when the whole team is involved in optimizing the fire that you're building, everybody recognizes that, in fact, winning more work than you can do is a part of what makes it possible to take in the kind of work that you really want to do. And so everybody on the team becomes a rainmaker, which now messes with my fire metaphor. Wood gatherer. Everybody on the team becomes a wood gatherer because we recognize that this is about optimizing that fire.
What would make a middle manager independent of you know, the company culture and type effective? What kind of skill sets would be, would you want to have in your backpack as you venture out, right? Whether you work for GE or for J&J or for Cisco or for Google, what do you think would set people up for success in the modern world?
One of the most important things you can do is be able to establish trust horizontally. And that has to do with just being absolutely straight and true to your word. And not being, this is also true, that if you are threatening with your ambitions, then you're in competition with your peers. And so a part of that is really being concerned with everybody else's success. And that's how trust is established. Which is, honest to God, caring deeply about the success of your peers.
You really set the bar high. So not only do you need to create work that the employees love to do, and you got to get senior management to realize the value of what you're doing without bragging about it, but at the same time, you also got to make all your peers happy. That seems like a 365 days a year, 360 degree job.
Yes, it is. I expect a lot of middle managers. I'm expecting way more of middle managers than the traditional model. I'm expecting you to be a designer, a broker, and honestly concerned about the success of others.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Dar, to have you again on the show.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I think we went deep into a very neglected part of the business, which is middle management, and I'm glad we got to talk about it.
We hope you enjoyed this discussion. If you did, be sure to subscribe, like, share, or comment. Until next time, let's make work matter.